Hi, and welcome to Choose Wisely Season 2. This is the podcast where we deconstruct food and sustainability topics with nuance and primary sources. Here we believe there are lots of right ways to eat well, and that we can't change a food system we don't truly understand. I'm your host, Caroline Nelson, and if my audio sounds like I'm recording on my cell phone, it's because I am. I gave birth just recently. I am lying here in my bed with my newborn. And so if you hear any kind of like piglet noises in the background, that's what's going on. I recorded this interview with Lily Nichols, who I'm about to tell you all about, ahead of time. And I'm just so excited to share it with you. I appreciate your patience with this audio. We're going to be back to normal very soon. But as of right now, my hard office chair just doesn't sound that good. Okay, so as I mentioned, today we have a big get for the pod. It's an honor to have Lily Nichols. A few people sent me her Instagram page when I shared that I was pregnant, and I have been hooked ever since. She is a registered dietitian, nutritionist, and certified diabetes educator. She's a researcher and an author with a passion for evidence-based prenatal nutrition. Lily's work is known for being research-focused, thorough, and critical of outdated dietary guidelines. She is the founder of the Institute for Prenatal Nutrition, co-founder of the Women's Health Nutrition Academy, and the author of 3 books, Real Food for Fertility, which just came out and it's so good, Real Food for Pregnancy, and Real Food for Gestational Diabetes. Lily's best-selling books have helped tens of thousands of women and babies and are used in university-level maternal nutrition and midwifery courses. She has even influenced prenatal nutrition policy internationally, and she writes at lilynicholsrdn.com. So today's episode is, if you're like me, it's going to turn everything upside down that you thought you knew about prenatal nutrition, gestational diabetes, and just nutrition in general, because while her books are focused on prenatal and fertility nutrition, I really find them to be such incredible guidelines for just how to eat well, how to live well, how to choose food that works for you. We cover a lot of the heavy hitter topics. We kick it off talking about gestational diabetes. We also cover why we need to get over our fear of salt and fat and meat when pursuing optimal health. And then we dig into misconceptions around folic acid and B12. And Lily tells us whether eating seafood during pregnancy is truly dangerous. Everyone who eats will enjoy this evidence-based podcast, whether or not you are ever going to have a baby or are interested in prenatal stuff. I really think this is an episode for everyone. And before we dive in, I just wanted to give you an overview of what gestational diabetes is. I just learned myself. If I hadn't gone through this whole prenatal thing, I still wouldn't know. Basically, during pregnancy, you can get a type of diabetes called gestational diabetes that will go away most of the time, but not always, after pregnancy. And you manage it generally with diet, but sometimes you get on insulin. And the main concern with it is that your baby gets too big in utero to have a vaginal delivery. So Lily alludes to this, but basically, you know, with gestational diabetes, it can limit your birth or delivery options. And so she found a way in her practice as a clinician to really manage gestational diabetes with diet and has had incredible results, has helped so many people. And I think it's so interesting because it's one of the things that when you hear about it, you know, from a lot of healthcare providers, they'll say there's nothing you can do about it. You know, you can manage it somewhat with diet, but basically you're going to get it or you're not. And I think that's true. And it's great to hear from Lily that there are things that we can do to manage it and possibly to prevent getting it in the first place. One more thing I wanted to mention, because I just learned what they are, is macronutrients. So Lily uses that term. I just learned what it was last year. When she says macros or anybody says macros, they're referring to carbohydrates, fat, and protein, kind of the big high-level nutrients that we consume in the largest amounts. And then she also references micronutrients as well. And I wanted to add that Lily's new book just came out. That's Real Food for Fertility, and it's linked in the show notes, so you can get all that there. All right, so a little bit of housekeeping before we dive into the episode. I wanted to welcome Marie, who is our newest regenerator over on the Patreon. Thank you so much for joining us and supporting this independent podcast. And our season two schedule is going to be a little bit different than season one. We are going to have a main feed episode every other Tuesday and then a Patreon exclusive episode once a month. All right, without further ado, let's go. This is Lily Nichols. Today's episode is brought to you by G5 Insurance. And if you're a rancher, farmer, or a small business owner, I want you to listen up, because G5 Agency insures everything that we do at Little Creek. These are our insurance agents, and they've been with us since the very beginning. I deal with a lot of different businesses through our work, and I am constantly blown away by how different it is working with G5. I feel like they actually know us, they're invested in us, they care about us. It feels like a very old-fashioned, personalized experience. Our agent will call me to check in. They will even send me a DM on Instagram. If I have any questions, I just know, I'm gonna run this by Eric, or I'm gonna shoot Lorraine an email. And they have really stayed with us as we've grown and really facilitated the growth of our business. Our insurance needs are complex. We're on a farm, we have heavy equipment, we work with livestock, we ship perishable food products, we run tourism events on different ranches with large animals, and we have business vehicles. Like, if you know anything about insurance, you know what a feat it is that we love our agents. G5 wasn't daunted by any of our needs. I am ride or die at this point, and I highly recommend them to anyone out there in need of business insurance. G5 can write in 48 states and has years of experience working with farms, ranches, and small businesses. You can find them at g5agency.com. So Lily, thank you so much for coming on. I read Real Food for Pregnancy. That's your second book, right?
Yes.
I read it in one day. I sat down, I was like, I'm just going to start this. I'm just going to check in. And then it was became one with my recliner and tore through it. It's been really impactful for me. So thank you for being here. I would love to start with a piece of your story that you share in the book. You were working as a clinician and you were seeing pregnant patients with gestational diabetes. And I did not know about gestational diabetes until I got pregnant myself. I didn't know how prevalent it is. Could you tell us about that time and what advice you started giving to these patients and what results you started to see?
Yeah. So early on in my career as a dietitian, I actually worked in gestational diabetes in a couple different ways. One of them was clinically, and then one of them was also working in public policy with the state of California's diabetes and pregnancy program, also called Sweet Success, which in many ways is a very forward-thinking organization in terms of like identifying and screening for gestational diabetes, like earlier in pregnancy and with more stringent and internationally accepted standards versus like the outdated ones that the US is still using. But I found in practice, when I applied their nutrition recommendations, and this, I mean, they're really not that much different than all the gestational diabetes recommendations given out, regardless of if you're following California's version. But I found they really didn't improve my clients' blood sugar levels very much. And sometimes they made their blood sugar levels get worse. Now, you have to understand at the time, especially as a new clinician, you're very risk averse. Even if in my own personal life, I had been on like the real food bandwagon for already like almost 10 years by that point, I still was definitely in the rule following mode. And certainly with pregnancy too, you don't want to do anything that could potentially be harmful. So I was kind of going into it a little naive in that I just assumed that the recommendations were what they were based on a huge body of evidence. When in reality, it's just kind of like, well, this is what we've always done. And there's a cherry-picked list of studies that makes people, you know, get worried about changing certain things. And then it just remains status quo recommendations. So even though I personally was already eating a more like protein forward, no fear of fat, I call it moderately low carb because I wasn't anti-carb, but just certainly didn't eat anywhere close to the recommended guidelines for carbs. I didn't feel comfortable recommending that to my clientele for fear that something could go terribly wrong if you recommend anything other than the guidelines. So that really is what sort of drove me to look into the literature a little more. Certainly, it didn't make sense to me that we should be recommending such a high carbohydrate diet for women who have a diagnosis, which one way of defining it is carbohydrate intolerance of pregnancy. So if you are intolerant to carbohydrates, meaning your blood sugar spikes too high when you have too large of a portion of them, why would we recommend a diet that has roughly half of its calories coming from carbohydrates? That didn't make sense to me. And a lot of my clients would complain, like, I can't like eat this amount of food. Like, this is a lot of food at one sitting.
Volume,
but also
yeah.
Like, I'm hungry 2 hours later. So like, it's too much food. They get a blood sugar spike and then they're hungry 2 hours later. Like, something wasn't lining up. And intuitively, of course, I'm like, well, the carbs are just way too high. But it took a lot of digging into the literature to uncover like how the carbohydrate guidelines were set to what they are. And whether or not there's wiggle room to reduce them to a safe level, like reduce them safely to not cause any harm, still make sure the woman got plenty of, you know, energy and micronutrients. And then, of course, vastly improve your glycemic response, because it's just, you reduce the carbohydrates, you dramatically improve people's blood sugar response to meals. It's just a default response, because carbohydrates are the only macronutrient that significantly elevates your blood sugar levels. So yeah, it was an interesting time period of kind of like getting your feet wet in the field and having to make a choice on what is the most ethical path forward. Like, is being a rule follower a better way to go? Like, is getting in trouble more important than improving patient outcomes? It really did kind of fall into a bit of an ethical dilemma where I felt like, you know what, I don't really have an alternative but to help these women, because way too many of them were unnecessarily required to go on medication and insulin. That changes your birth options. It changes your risk factors for a number of different things. It was like, we don't need to be doing this if we simply shift their macronutrient ratio even a little bit. It's not always like a huge drastic change, and that surprises people. So yeah, that was definitely a turning point in my career, and ultimately is what led to, you know, my first book, Real Food for Gestational Diabetes.
And so as you started to share your real food or ancestral food approach, for the audience who may not be familiar, can you give us a sense of just a basic overview of what the advice that you give in following that diet roughly?
In the real food kind of approach.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, you know, my recommendations have shifted slightly over the years in terms of how I present the information, I suppose. There's a couple ways of looking at it. You can look at it from like a macronutrient perspective, where we want to think about like which foods contain which macronutrients and to make sure we have like a good ratio for blood sugar balance. I also tend to look at it from a micronutrient perspective as well. So your micronutrients being vitamins and minerals, for the most part, which foods are richest in those, and then prioritizing your micronutrient-rich foods.
Mm-hmm.
Either way you slice it, you end up in the same place, where generally for most individuals, you are titrating up protein intake. It depends on the person, but usually like increasing fat intake or swapping out some fats for healthier whole food fats versus like refined vegetable oils and fake butter margarine things. And all the snack foods that have all those same oils in them. And then carbohydrate wise, really shifting your carbohydrates to more whole food, unrefined sources instead of the white sugar, white flour, corn syrup sources, which it shocks people. But I mean, ultra processed food makes up about 60% of the average American's caloric intake. So those are foods made primarily of added sugars, white flour, low quality oils like vegetable oils, Crisco, and that sort of stuff. And then like all the weird ingredients that they add to make it taste and look good. Mm-hmm. So your colors, your flavors, your stabilizing agents, your preservatives, whatever. Ultra processed foods have very little in terms of micronutrients because you've taken like the starch out of the whole wheat or the starch or the sugar out of the corn. You've taken the oil out of a food that really up until the last 100 years, nobody was even extracting oil from corn because take a bite of corn on the cob. There's not that much oil in it, right? You have to go through this huge industrial process to even extract oils from those things versus more traditional fats. So shifting the balance away from the ultra processed foods just to more whole foods generally does it. So how this looks in terms of food, since I'm talking kind of high level micro and macronutrients, is prioritizing protein at every meal, varying your sources of it, but generally including some animal proteins like meat, fish, eggs, dairy products, coupled with plant proteins as well. I'm not anti those. So as tolerated, nuts, seeds, beans, legumes, and so forth. Again, choosing your carbohydrates from unrefined sources. So certainly whole grains over refined is better, although everybody has different carbohydrate tolerance. So there's some people who can't have a whole lot of like, you know, grains and potatoes and whatnot, but if you do well with them, great. But thinking of like, if you're having potatoes, you're like cutting up an actual potato and like roasting it in, you know, tallow or coconut oil or something. It's not a parboiled, parfried, frozen potato that's been coated in wheat starch and sugar and fried in low quality oil. And then, you know, right? It's a different, it's a completely different animal in terms of how your body processes that. So certainly that, your vegetables, fruits, whatnot. And again, focusing on fat sources where it's, you know, an ancestral food. So our animal fats, our full fat dairy products, the fats that naturally come in foods, like the fat that's in your salmon or your steak or the skin on your chicken, like those are things that we should actually all be eating instead of avoiding, like the guidelines all tell us to do. And, you know, unfortunately, as you get stricter and stricter on taking the fat out of everything, you not only miss out on some micronutrients that are only found in these fats, but you also dramatically reduce the satiety factor for any of your meals. So then you're just hungry all the time. Usually your blood sugar is a little more imbalanced and you just simply want to eat a ton. So we need to get to a happy medium with fats where we're not fearing them or taking them out of the foods where they naturally occur.
When you did begin to take this real food approach with your clients who had gestational diabetes or were at risk for gestational diabetes, what did you start to see? What were the results of that?
I mean, you see, blood sugar is a cool thing because it is constantly in flux, right? So you change somebody's food and you immediately see the results like at that meal. So
yes, I'm testing mine right now.
Four
times a day. Yeah.
Yeah, with gestational diabetes, I mean, your blood sugar response can vary meal to meal, morning to morning when you're looking at your fasting blood sugar based on what you've eaten or what you've changed in your lifestyle. So certainly you see the results immediately. So in terms of you know, blood sugar responses, that was obvious. You come in the next week for your check-in, we upload your blood sugar results, and wow, all the readings that used to be high are suddenly in range or closer to it, at least. Sometimes there is an adaptation period, but generally you see things come down relatively rapidly. The satiety factor was better, so not hungry all the time. Cravings were better when you're getting sufficient protein and fat and managing your carbohydrate intake in a way that you're avoiding those blood sugar spikes. You don't get the blood sugar crashes either. So you're not starving and your body isn't physiologically programmed to tell you to seek more carbs or sweets or uppers like caffeine because your energy level. It senses you have enough energy. Okay, our energy is steady. We're good. I'm not starving. Therefore, the cravings don't even show up. Certainly things like distension, heartburn went way down. Weight gain stabilized to a healthy place, as you would expect for pregnancy, instead of being higher than average. You'd see blood pressure often improve because blood sugar and blood pressure tend to go hand in hand. So that was definitely a shocker for me, at least early on when I didn't know more about the physiology of it. But like if I had a client referred for preeclampsia who maybe like passed the gestational diabetes screening, but probably actually shouldn't have passed the test, I'd do a diet recall and it'd be like all carbs, like tons of carbs. And so the advice that I'd give, not even, you know, even from a blood pressure consideration at that time, but like just from macronutrient balance, like, let's get you some more protein in here. Let's do a little more of this, a little less of that. And you'd see their blood pressure go down fairly dramatically. So what works for, you know, preventing or treating preeclampsia, there's actually quite a few overlaps with gestational diabetes. Often you get one of those pregnancy complications and you have the other as well. So yeah, dramatic, dramatic shifts.
What you're saying is something that I feel like I'm really trying to learn more and more. We talk about our health in such siloed ways, like here's what your blood pressure is and we need to lower your blood pressure or whatever it is. And everything is so system-wide and overlapping.
Yes.
So it's really interesting that you were seeing kind of maybe unforeseen improvements in other areas or for other outcomes. In your book, you include sample meal plans. And one of the things that I noticed right away, I was like, these just do not feel like the normal, quote unquote, like sample meal plans that you would see from any other book you pick up on the shelf of how to eat healthy. And what I mean by that is the food looks delicious. Like the meals are meals that you want to eat. Yeah. You know, it's like full fat Greek yogurt with berries and a side of an egg fried in ghee. Like, oh my gosh, am I at a 5-star resort? So my question is, was it hard, and is it still hard when you have clients to get past the idea that healthy food, I'm saying that in air quotes, should be bland or boring or tasteless, and also that animal foods can be part of a healthy diet?
Yes, absolutely. And that has long been the challenge, really the entirety of my career. I mean, I had to survive like dietetics school. So I was already eating real food before I went through dietetic school, right? So I did a lot of holding my tongue and rolling my
eyes. You're sitting there like, no.
Yeah. I remember we had like a diet recall assignment in one of my, or a diet analysis assignment in one of my classes in my undergrad. And I can't remember exactly, but I'm pretty sure when we ran my macros, it was something like 50 to 60% of calories from fat, which sounds insane. Like if you don't know anything about nutrition, you're like, oh my God, half your diet is fat. Like it's actually very, very easy. If you're not cutting out fats left and right, it's very easy to get half of your calories from fat because they're more concentrated. But the macro ratio was like way different than the, you need to eat less than 30% of your calories from fat. Anyways, yeah, people definitely looked at me like, what? You appear to be healthy, but you're eating so much fat.
I love that too, because I had a friend on recently on the podcast and she talked about like, you are your own evidence, and looking healthy and feeling good are like indicators that a lot of us overlook. It's like we're looking for outward sources to affirm, are we doing the right thing? This has happened to me early in my pregnancy when people started to find out. We'd be out to dinner and I'd order something. And I practice intuitive eating. I think I follow roughly a real food diet. And someone at the table said, oh, you shouldn't get that. You should get this. It's not just about you anymore. You need to eat this way for the baby. And I was like, my hackles, because I knew what I was ordering was like really a really great nutrient dense meal.
Yeah.
And what they were telling me to eat was basically broccoli. which is fine, but like it's not, it didn't sound delicious to me at the time.
Right,
So it is definitely, and it can like stress people out. I think we've internalized, especially, you know, those of us who are like children of the 80s and 90s when it was such an anti-saturated fat time, which brings me to my next question about saturated fats. Things are really shifting in that space. They're kind of slowly being de-villainized, or at least what I'm hearing now.
In some circles.
exactly. Like from the sort of mainstream nutritional, you know, dietitians, they'll say like, well, they're just not, it's not like what we thought, you know, they're not as bad as what we thought. They're probably okay. So anyway, I just wanted to ask you, like, what is your outlook on saturated fats?
Yeah. And I realized I didn't even like circle back to answering your full question before, but the first thing I had to convince myself of, and this I convinced myself of a long time ago, meaning research did a lot and felt like I was comfortable eating this way, was the concern over salt, fat, cholesterol. And of course, with the fat and cholesterol basically lumps together for avoiding animal foods or avoiding meat. Those are like the three things that you need to reconcile in your brain to begin actually embracing nutrient dense foods. So yeah, the saturated fat conversation, ultimately the research that was originally done to demonize saturated fat was full of flaws and bias. Mm-hmm. This goes all the way back to Ansel Keys' work. There is a book actually by Nina Teicholz I recommend people read called The Big Fat Surprise, which goes into the history of this. But essentially he did a, you know, a dietary survey sort of studies in different parts of the world, cherry picked seven countries from there to present data on. And he published his seven countries study, which showed higher intakes of saturated fat was associated with higher rates of cardiovascular disease, heart disease. And the research, of course, that he didn't publish from all these other places was that this wasn't always an observed correlation in every country. So you have countries at high and low levels of saturated fat intake with high and low levels of heart disease. Likewise, with high saturated fat intake, the same thing. It's kind of all over the map. There really is no association. And now we have, decades later, an abundance of data showing exactly that. Yes, saturated fat can elevate certain blood lipid markers, though this is different person to person, but no, those markers aren't necessarily associated with higher heart disease risk or mortality. And in some cases, higher saturated fat intake is actually protective against things like stroke. So certainly the correlation was not as strong as it was originally presented. And there's even been data that goes a little bit deeper where they look at sort of like the food matrix of like, where is the saturated fat actually coming from? And they have actually found that when the saturated fat is coming from whole food sources, I'm thinking specifically of a study that looked at red meat, dark chocolate, and high fat dairy products, that's not associated with any heart risk or mortality risk. In other words, it's probably the foods as a whole that you're choosing and the quality of your diet as a whole that you're choosing, whether or not that saturated fat is coming in from a baked good made with, you know, palm oil and like white flour and sugar and no other nutrients, or if that saturated fat is coming from a steak, which, yeah, it has saturated fat and cholesterol. It also has tons of micronutrients, a lot of really important amino acids that your body requires to function. So I think that's sort of like the new generation of research is really sort of questioning some of those early findings. The unfortunate part is that Ansel Keys' work did very strongly influence policy. And so the origins, like there are first Dietary Guidelines for America was published, I believe, in like the early 80s. And that's where this whole low-fat era began. I mean, I myself am a child of the 80s. I remember going to the grocery store with my mom and seeing Snackwell's cookies, and it said yes. Sugar-free. I thought it meant that you got free sugar with the cookies. I was like, Mom, you can get free sugar with this. I remember looking at, she wouldn't buy Capri Suns because they had corn syrup. My mom was into health, right? And she wouldn't buy a lot of these like high sugar, artificial food dye kind of items, which I am grateful for.
She was ahead of her time.
Stage of my life. She was. and I remember seeing corn syrup and be like, but it's corn, you know?
Exactly.
Sadly, you have like plenty of adult Americans and others who think the same thing. Oh, it's from corn. Oh, it's fine. Ooh, evaporated cane juice. That sounds healthy, you know, not realizing that these things are just sugar. But I think our dietary guidelines really hammered in the fat thing so strongly, ingrained that in all of us. Avoid fat and avoid cholesterol as much as you possibly can. And then you add the salt to it. So, it's a hot mess. I'm often having, like, I have to do a lot of re-education on these topics because you can't possibly eat a whole food nutrient dense diet if you have not reconciled those three lies. Until you do that, you're going to think I'm completely crazy. Yes. And part of the reason that I cite my work so heavily is that the education and indoctrination and like marketing campaigns around what is healthy and not healthy have gotten it so backwards that I just sound like some other crazy person who's come up with some follow my diet plan. And really it's like, no, there's actually, this isn't just my opinion. There's actually some pretty strong data that this is actually this way. And that is actually that way. And you don't need to be fearful of this, but maybe hold back on the sugar, white flour, and, you know, corn oil, right? It's really tricky.
And something that I've learned just from researching different studies on this podcast is how, I just didn't understand this before, how variable the quality of studies are, and how we also have this bias where we only study things. Well, first of all, like we sort of follow, like things that are well-funded get studied. And so of course, like there's an incentive for certain industries to have certain outcomes to fund certain studies. Yes. And nobody is out here being like, I'm going to make a study. I mean, I'm not saying nobody, but right now in our current climate, it's not like profitable or beneficial to go like, I'm going to look for the 10 health benefits of red meat, for example. Like that's not where we're at. Anyway, there's just all this. And then how correlation not equaling causation, and how a lot of these outcomes that we see where things are, you know, let's say red meat being associated with cardiovascular disease, these studies are so confounded by such huge variables, basically of like the standard American diet, that it's very hard to tease out pieces. But when, you know, when these studies get reported on, that nuance in that context is totally left out.
Yeah. There's actually a dietary pattern, just to follow up on this, called meat and French fries, just so you know. There's a dietary pattern that's named that. And so when you find these studies that suggest that meat is harmful to your health because they're just observing health outcomes and people living their day-to-day life, eating whatever, and you have a group of people who's maybe more health conscious and following sort of standard dietary guidelines, low fat, more plants, salads, low cholesterol, whatever, to a group of people who are like, I don't give a crap about these guidelines. And they're eating like hamburgers, hot dogs on buns with French fries, with big sodas, binge drinking on the weekends, smoking cigarettes. And you go to compare outcomes. It's like, well, you can say that the meat is the problem, but was it the French fries, the bun, the soda, the alcohol, the smoking, the disrupted circadian rhythm, the different socioeconomic status and access to things? Like, what is, so we can of course make correlations between just about anything. People really do seem to zero in on certain things as like, you know, extrapolating a causation aspect when it's really just, well, what happens when you give people, there's been studies, for example, where you give people a Mediterranean diet, but it's a Mediterranean diet that includes some red meat every week, which mm-hmm. typically by Western definitions of a Mediterranean diet is a no-no. And you see good outcomes, right? Mm-hmm. You don't see any detrimental effects of that red meat because it's in the context of a diet that's otherwise pretty low in processed foods and relatively nutrient dense. Mm-hmm. So I think that's one of those things we really need to consider is like, what's the whole dietary pattern being observed? Because that absolutely affects the outcomes. And the observational studies are tricky. Nutrition is hard to study. It really is. It's hard to get a good study design.
Yeah. Thank you for driving that home. I think it's just something I didn't appreciate before I started reading studies for myself. I had no idea how, I guess, imperfect. Yeah. You can't, humans are not mice that you can stick in a lab and play with variables ethically. So something I learned from your work is that nutrients from vegetables, especially antioxidants, are best absorbed when eaten with fat. Can you talk about why that is and also why you really recommend leaving the fat in things, whole milk, you know, whole dairy products?
Yeah. So on the vegetable part, if the antioxidant happens to be, or nutrient happens to be a fat-soluble nutrient, because we have water-soluble nutrients and fat-soluble nutrients, if it's a fat-soluble nutrient such as lycopene or beta-carotene, the absorption of those compounds is enhanced when there is fat there as a vehicle to improve absorption in the gut. So yeah, when you eat a salad that has low-fat or non-fat salad dressing versus a salad that has whole-fat salad dressing, and maybe you include like a hard-boiled egg with it and some nuts or something like that, you drastically enhance the amount of those beneficial compounds that you absorb. Same goes for, you know, any food with any of these fat-soluble nutrients. Fat enhances absorption of those things. When it comes to the other aspect that you asked about, which was, remind me,
leaving
the fat on foods, fat
products, yeah, and non-foods.
The fat naturally occurs in food for a reason, and there are, again, nutrients that are fat soluble that are concentrated in those fatty portions of the food. So with dairy products, your fat soluble vitamins are all in the dairy fat, and vitamins A, D, and K2 that are in there enhance your body's absorption and utilization of the calcium that's also in the milk, but in the non-fatty portion of the milk. So when you start taking those things out, you're reducing like the, you know, amount of nutrition that your body can actually utilize from what you're taking in. There's also, I think another good example is, you know, poultry or chicken with the skin.
Yeah.
Yes, there's fat soluble nutrients in there, but there's also things other than fat in the skin. So the skin on poultry is really rich in collagen, and like the same collagen you need for your skin and your connective tissue and your bones and your hair and nails and everything. And of course, when you're pregnant, for your baby, for your uterus, for the integrity of your amniotic sac. And when you take off the skin of the chicken, you're not just taking off the fat because, oh no, this is a source of too many calories. You're taking off really significant portion of the amount of collagen that you can get from it. Our needs for some of these amino acids, often concentrated in collagen, are substantially higher during pregnancy because your demands for them are higher. You need more for your own body, and you need more for your baby's growth as well. So I think we need to look beyond things as just being fat. And when you start demonizing foods where the fat is like an incorporated part of the food, so like a steak with marbling or a fattier cut of meat, like a chuck roast or something that you're making into pot roast, where then like the fat rises to the top, and some recipes will have you like discard that or discard the fat off your bone broth. Those fats are there like for a reason. When you take them out, again, you're reducing the level of those micronutrients you're consuming. Or if you don't eat those foods whatsoever because they're too high in fat, then you're missing out on, you know, you cut out meat because it's high in saturated fat, you're missing out on choline, B12, iron, zinc, B6. I mean, you name it. There's a huge mm-hmm. long list of nutrients in some of these foods that just so happen to naturally contain fat. And really the only reason we are against them as a society is because of those outdated guidelines that are against saturated fat and cholesterol. If mm-hmm. you remove those two obstacles, well, now they've added the whole climate stuff to it as well, which is a, mm-hmm. that's a topic whole for other... Diana Rogers of Sustainable Dish to tackle, not me. But for the most part, it's those two factors. You remove those two things and say you do an analysis on the most nutrient-dense foods on the planet, which has actually been done by researcher Ty Beale. I recommend people look that up. Meat.
Yes, I live by that chart.
Yeah, red meat is pretty high up on that chart. In fact, of all the most nutrient-dense foods on the planet, only one of them was of plant origin. It was leafy greens. Everything mm-hmm. else was some mm-hmm. form of animal food.
And red for the meat, audience, organ meat,
yeah.
Seafood. I'm trying to remember what else is on the list.
Shellfish,
oysters are really high.
Bivalve shellfish, liver. Dairy, small fish. Yeah, those are the ones off the top mm-hmm. of my head. I do have a research brief on my Instagram on the study if people want to dig through my archives and find it. But yeah, it's like, okay, it's not just me looking at nutrient databases. There's also these larger research teams who have done more comprehensive analysis than I have the software for. And they come mm-hmm. to the same findings. Like mm-hmm. you can meet your micronutrient requirements from a relatively small portion of some of these foods. And interestingly, I think I'd add that the satiety factor for those foods is much higher. So you fill up and you feel good and satisfied for a longer period of time when you're including some of these nutrient dense foods versus these kind of empty calorie items where you just want to keep eating and eating and eating and eating, like as if there's, you know, protein requirement or a micronutrient requirement your body's trying to hit.
I've really noticed this. Let's say I'm snacking on popcorn. I could eat the whole bowl, two bowls of it. Like I'm never done with popcorn.
Yeah.
Like maybe only when like the saltiness officially burns my lips. Am I like, I've had enough. And what I've noticed with certain snacks like that is if I add a protein, like if I have a handful of nuts and with the popcorn, I am done snacking so much faster. Like protein has really been something that I've used as a tool to actually satisfy.
Yes.
Like I thought that big bowl of popcorn would satisfy, and it doesn't. It tastes good, but it's like there's no end to the wanting.
Yes.
Of it.
Yes. And there's actually I have hypothesis out there called the protein leverage hypothesis, stating exactly that we will eat until we hit our protein requirements. And there's all sorts of studies where they change the amount of protein that they provide and watch the, you know, amount in an all you can eat sort of situation, they watch the amount of food that people eat, the total calories they consume. And as you titrate the protein up, people hit like a set point with the amount of energy they consume. Whereas if the protein is too low, you keep eating and eating and eating and eating and eating. So what have we created with essentially from the dietary guidelines and like the food industry responding to it? And all the hyper palatable foods that they create. I don't think they're trying to meet any guidelines by creating all those hyper palatable foods. But when you have, you know, people eating more than half of their calories coming from ultra processed foods, which are by default low in protein and not satiating whatsoever, and then engineered with like flavor and chemicals and combinations
texture.
That make you want to keep eating and eating and eating, then you end up with people just consuming way, way, way more energy than their bodies actually need. Then thus you end up with, you know, the obesity
and
epidemic we're observing.
More sedentary lifestyles. Than
more sedentary
had.
On top of it. It's all of it combined, but the protein leverage thing is huge. And that is something I've been harping on people getting enough protein, I think, since the beginning. But my resolve for the importance of this, I think, has only been strengthened over time as we have new research coming out on the importance of adequate protein and just how much the guidelines missed the mark on how much we require. There was actually a really great study published just this year challenging protein requirements and giving what they believe is like an optimal RDA for various groups of people. And oftentimes, you know, we need to increase the RDA by like 50%, sometimes double it in some cases. Certainly in pregnancy, they underestimated protein requirements by at least 73%. You know, they're not 5% off, they're 73% off. Like, that is a too large of a margin of error for us to take the rest of your guidelines very seriously, you know?
It's so fascinating. I'm going to track that. I like that theory of yours a lot. I like it a lot. And I've noticed just myself of like, I just put an egg on everything. It's like every meal we raise, you know, our own eggs here. We're on a farm. And nice. I'm like, if I have any doubts, just put an egg on it. You'll be good. And it's been funny trying to test my blood sugar 4 times a day because, you know, it's like fasting and then 2 hours after every meal. I'm like, so a lot of times I don't feel that I need to eat 3 meals a day when I eat that way. You know, I'm not eating huge quantities, but I'm just full all day, even though, you know, being pregnant, it's just been interesting. So I want to just briefly hit on folic acid. This is like the thing everybody tells you get pregnant. If you do one thing, make sure you take folic acid. And I was told that very same thing. And I bought my little folic acid. And then I don't know whether it was from your work or where I learned this first, but I didn't understand that this was not a naturally occurring thing. Like folic acid, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's man-made and it's not the same as folate, which comes from food. So can you debunk the folic acid thing for us?
Yeah. I have, for people who want to dive deeper, let me just throw this out there. I have this massive article on my website on folic acid versus folate. Breaking it down probably more clearly and succinctly than I can in an interview by default. Writing is my clearest form of communication. But I will say this. So folate is like an umbrella term. You can refer to any type of folate as folate. Okay. So folic acid does fall under the umbrella of folate, as do the other 150 plus different forms that naturally occur in food. However, the majority of the forms that occur in food is in the form known as methylfolate. That is the form also that your body maintains, you know, your serum levels of folate are like 95 to 98% maintained in the form of methylfolate. What's in cord blood? Same thing. So what's in the baby's circulation? Same thing, right? Folic acid is a man-made compound. It doesn't naturally occur in nature. It's not a naturally occurring part of those 150 different forms. Like the structure of it is sort of at the heart of those, but there's all these other extra things that are attached. And in biochemistry or organic chemistry, you change like one tiny little thing on a compound and it completely can change how it works in your body. So folic acid, I think, was chosen as the default form for supplementation because it's very stable. It's a stable compound. So it's easy to like add to fortified foods that are going to be baked at a high temperature and still make sure the folic acid is in there at the end. It's also really inexpensive to manufacture because it's a very simple compound relative to the other types of folate. And if you have like an overt severe deficiency in folate and you supplement with folic acid, you can improve folate levels to a certain degree and depending on your genetics, but still. So if you have an issue such as neural tube defects, a very serious birth defect, which happens very early in pregnancy, oftentimes before you even know you're pregnant, and you have a population that's not eating whole foods, which is where you get your folate, okay? Your folate's in like leafy greens, legumes, and liver primarily. And then there's a handful of other things, your seaweed, your sunflower seeds, your asparagus, your beets, you know, whole foods that people aren't eating enough of. So they decided to fortify the food supply with folic acids so that all the bread that we're consuming, you know, has it in there. And because you are improving the folate status of some degree of the population, you do see somewhat of a reduction in neural tube defects, but there's still a significant amount of them that are not prevented. Like at least 30% of neural tube defects happen in women who actually do have sufficient folate and have been supplementing with folic acid, and they still occur. Because it's not a lack of folic acid that's a problem. It's a impaired methylation that's a problem. And you need lots of different nutrients, not just folate, And for some individuals, folic acid won't even participate in methylation because it needs to be converted. You don't have the genetic machinery, the enzyme activity to actually utilize it.
Something like 20% or of the population can't absorb it?
It's like 40 to 60% has some degree of a reduced ability to metabolize folic acid. So it's not that they have no ability, but they end, depending on which type of this genetic variation you have, it's called MTHFR, your enzyme activity, the one that metabolizes folate and folic acid, can be reduced by anywhere from 35 to 70%. Mm-hmm. So if you have one of the severe variations where your enzyme activity is reduced 70%, your body really struggles to metabolize folic acid. You can't put it to use. So it builds up in your bloodstream at high levels, but it's not supporting methylation. And in fact, it can actually clog up the whole folate methylation cycle and impair methylation further. It's called unmetabolized folic acid. You can look it up in the literature, and I write about it in the article. So we really need to be focusing, in my opinion, on improving our folate status. Yes, absolutely. I'm not averse to us working on that at all. I don't deny that folate plays a role in preventing neural tube defects, but I think we should be focusing more on the type of folate that everybody population-wide can metabolize, and also focusing on improving our intake of all of the nutrients that support methylation and also have been proven in the research to reduce the risk of neural tube defects. And the list is long. It's not just folate. It's B12, B6, inositol, choline, betaine, zinc. There's a lot of things involved. Riboflavin, that's definitely a big one. But a lot of the B vitamins, essentially. Which,
wow.
Where do you get your B vitamins?
Animal
Oftentimes
foods.
Oftentimes in animal foods, right?
Like, is this a pop quiz? Did I get an A?
You got an A. Certainly, like with B12, you're only finding it in animal foods. With folate, the number one source is actually liver. And it just so happens that your like cofactor for your MTHFR enzyme to run is riboflavin, vitamin B2, which is found in highest amounts in organ meats and dairy products. So even if you have a sluggish MTHFR because you have one of those variations, if you bump up your riboflavin intake, even without any folate supplementation, you can improve your folate status. And I am not saying this from, this is just my opinion. Like, there's literal research on supplementing people just with riboflavin and you can improve it. So it's like all these nutrients work together. We can't just focus on one, and we probably don't want to be focusing only on the one that is in a form that a significant portion of the population has trouble metabolizing.
Yes. It's just so interesting that at no point in any of my prenatal care were whole foods or even dietary sources of any of these nutrients discussed or recommended. Nobody's saying like, consider eating more spinach. Consider, you know, some organ meat. It's absolutely not happening. No one was even really interested in what I eat unless I had failed the gestational diabetes test.
Right.
In which case,
they tell you to eat tons of carbs and your blood sugar would get worse. So, yeah, good luck.
I know. I have felt like such a bad patient, problem child in there.
Welcome to the club.
I'm getting more comfortable now. You went super viral in an interview talking about consumption of fish during pregnancy. And this is one of those things that everyone's like, oh my gosh, don't do it. Can you talk to us about what the research actually says and, you know, what we gain from seafood and if there's anything we need to be mindful of if you're pregnant or trying to conceive and consuming it?
Yes, this interview I did with Max Lugavere on his podcast, there was a conversation that was turned into an Instagram reel about seafood being so beneficial in pregnancy. And when you get something that gets, you know, multi-million views, I think we're up to 8-point-something million views, you're bound to get all the comments. Because of course, like a one-minute reel, you can't give the context of a full interview. So nobody heard the full conversation unless you listened to the interview. I ended up doing like a follow-up article on my blog diving into this a little bit, because one of the good things about having people question you is it makes, or at least for me, it makes me question myself and be like, did I miss anything on this? And there were some good points brought up in some of the, you know, critique comments, one of which was like, can you get too much fish? Mm-hmm. And also like, what about the mercury? I mean, I talk about the mercury already. I cover that in Real Food for Pregnancy, but yep. I did find more data from a very large cohort. There was a systematic review on seafood consumption during pregnancy and neurocognitive development, where they looked at over 44 studies. It had over 100,000 mother-offspring pairs. And mm-hmm. they were looking at, from all those studies, like, again, systematic reviews and meta-analyses are some of the best studies to look at, because you're aggregating so much data together and finding the similarities and the outliers so you can draw more reliable conclusions mm-hmm. from all of this data. What I found fascinating was that there was no level of seafood intake where there was harm to neurocognitive development. So overall, we've always known seafood is beneficial to brain development. There's lots of micronutrients in there that are beneficial. You got your DHA, your iodine, B12, iron, zinc, choline, so on and so forth. But there's always been a concern, like if you eat too much, because fish can be a source of mercury, maybe we could be causing harm. Mm-hmm. And I've always kind of defaulted to just recommending, it's actually in line with the FDA guidance, one guideline I don't disagree with, which is about 12 ounces of seafood, low mercury seafood mm-hmm. per week. And this study found that there were benefits to neurocognitive development with as little as 4 ounces of seafood per week. Let me qualify that the average seafood consumption among US women is 3 ounces a week. Okay. So again, most people need to eat a little more, mm-hmm. even if you want to default to that tiny, you know, single portion. Benefits were definitely seen at 12 ounces, but they even went all the way up to 100 ounces. There are populations who consume over 100 ounces of seafood per week. It turns out no harms to neurocognitive development. Even more interestingly is they looked at mercury. And so we have some of the studies that were measuring, you know, mercury levels in the moms, analyzing the amount in the diet, mercury levels, you know, in the hair, whatever. And women who consume more seafood generally actually had higher mercury levels, but that did not correlate with lower neurocognitive development or lower IQ in their babies. But if their mercury was coming from places other than seafood, it did correlate with poorer neurological development. So there's something about the fact that it's coming in the seafood. There's a couple reasons this could be the case. A, you're taking in a lot more micronutrients that are known to benefit baby's brain development. So you're like offsetting any potential deficiencies in those mm-hmm. things. And that's overtly beneficial. There's also selenium in seafood that actually prevents mercury from being as toxic in the body and enhances how much of it your body like excretes and gets rid of. The other aspect is that when you're getting mercury from some of these other sources, like it can bioaccumulate potentially a little more, isn't metabolized as easily like out of your system. Mm-hmm. But I found that really fascinating that it wasn't the mercury coming from seafood that was problematic, even if mother had higher levels, it was when it was coming from other sources. So it's funny that everybody has like zeroed in on seafood as being problematic due to mercury. When like actually the number one source of exposure to mercury is amalgam fillings. So the silver fillings that a lot of people mm-hmm. have in their molars, they're at least small, you know, it's 50% mercury by weight. They call them silver fillings. It's not silver. It's that there's actually mercury in there. And there's mercury vapors that are released from that you are now ingesting or absorbing when you chew or have a hot beverage or whatever. That's actually the number one source of mercury exposure.
So and interesting.
Many parts of Europe have had guidelines on not putting in mercury fillings in women who are pregnant or breastfeeding or going to get pregnant, knowing that it's a source of mercury exposure. The FDA finally issued some guidance on it. I believe it was back in 2020 or 2021. recommending that dentists not place amalgam fillings during those times. Again, if you have them, that's a trickier thing because trying to get them out and remediate that, you want to actually do that when you're outside of your, when you're not pregnant, not breastfeeding, maybe have some time before pregnancy to detoxify that mercury. But, you know, we get very siloed in our view of, you know, toxins per se and can't see the forest through the trees, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. Like mm-hmm. nowadays, almost everything has some level of contamination. Mm-hmm. If I'm going to consume some mercury, I would like for it to come with some selenium, DHA, iodine, all these good things. Knowing my body has the resources to, you know, better excrete it than eating a by default nutrient deficient diet that doesn't consume any seafood whatsoever. Mm-hmm. So, you know, pick your poison, but they're find any food and you'll find a so-called problem with it and a reason yes, to absolutely. Avoid it, you know?
That's so true. And thank you for taking us into that seafood conversation. And I will link to your blogs. I think there's folks that are going to want to go down the rabbit hole on it. I really want to talk about your new book. Before we get there, I have one more question for you. You're very forthright in your book about the challenges of trying to either get pregnant or, you know, meet all your nutrient needs while pregnant on a vegetarian diet. And I know we have vegetarian listeners. And one of the things that you share is talk about the role of B12 and the role of iron. I have heard, you know, I see all the time, oh no, it's not true that only B12 is found in animal products. And then I hear, oh no, it is. It's only found in animal products. So can you break that down for us and for the vegetarians? Yeah. How can they make sure they're getting their B12 and their iron and other things like that?
Yes. And actually I'm going to pull up some writing that I have on that. That'll actually be in book number 3. Because this is a very important consideration. Yeah, so B12 is a really important vitamin. It is truly only found in animal foods, at least in significant quantities or usable forms, which we'll talk about. As I mentioned, you know, it's very important for methylation, which can be involved in the prevention of neural tube defects, but there's also, you know, a lot of research on it's important for sperm health and egg quality, supporting implantation, embryonic development, plays a really important role in fetal brain development over time. So it is a concern if the diet is low in B12. I don't know that this answer will kind of go into the full spectrum of like whether a vegetarian diet can be nutritionally adequate, because B12 is a very easy one to supplement. On the side, which absolutely should be done if you follow a vegetarian or vegan diet. Absolutely, you should be taking not just what B12 is in your prenatal, but a separate supplement on top of it. The reason for that is the RDA for B12 is set at least 3 times lower than it should be to support optimal levels during both pregnancy and lactation. So if you, a lot of prenatals, depends on the brand, many of them only have 100% of the daily value for these vitamins.
Okay.
100% of the daily value is 3 times too low, right? So like you can't go by those percentages to see whether it's adequate or accurate or not. And there's quite a bit of research on vegetarians and vegans in particular, where you want at least 50 micrograms as a supplement. So anybody listening just to the short end of this, you do want a B12 supplement for sure. Generally speaking, like the rates of B12 insufficiency are significantly higher in women who follow a more plant-based or vegetarian diet. For example, some data has found that 62% of vegetarian pregnant women are deficient in B12. Again, that can be corrected with supplementation, but even women who eat a low meat diet can be low in B12 as well. So it would be one that you want to check. Of course, if you're vegetarian but eating a fairly substantial amount of eggs and dairy products, you're much more likely to meet those needs because those would be a food source of it. The question about whether B12 can be reliably obtained from plant foods is one I've gotten a lot. So there is a myth that you can meet your B12 needs from fermented foods and algae. And these foods mm-hmm. actually can, in some cases, have some B12, but it's actually not in the right form. It's in these biologically inactive lookalikes. They call them B12 analogs. Okay. And these can clog up your B12 receptors, then actually worsen your vitamin B12 status because they're not actually functional. They look like B12, but they don't function like B12. And some of the early nutrition research before our lab methods had improved stated ooh, this algae is really high in B12. And as laboratory analysis has improved over time, it's oh, wait, those are actually B12 analogs. So saying with the folic acid, you change these tiny little things on a compound and it changes completely how it functions in your body. This is one of those scenarios.
Okay.
There was actually one study in vegans who attempted to meet their B12 needs from these so-called alternative sources. This included algae, kombucha, and other fermented foods. And those individuals, ones who were not supplementing on the side, they actually had the most severe degree of vitamin B12 deficiency when they compared them to vegans who did consume a B12 supplement.
Okay.
So I think this is just a very important point for the vegan community. We have to be honest about what nutrients we actually get and where and in what quantities and in what form. And this is an area, it hits close to home for me because I used to be vegetarian. I still have loved ones who actually eat a mostly vegan diet, long-term vegans, and I see the health consequences. And I understand there's so many different rationales for eating that way. Many of them involve sort of love for animals or hate of poor animal welfare and farming conditions or, concerns over environmental health or religious reasons. There's so many reasons, right?
Mm-hmm.
But we have to ground ourselves in reality on the nutrition aspect of it. So mm-hmm. this is a topic I stick my neck out on. I get a lot of flack for it, a mm-hmm. lot.
Mm-hmm.
I think I get even more thank yous from people who are heavily entrenched in that way of eating, who start to see things a different way and then can observe for themselves, as you talked about, the mindful eating component. The changes in their body and their health and how they feel and their mental health, trajectory of their pregnancies, whether they can even get pregnant, how well they heal from birth, so on and so forth, by incorporating even some animal foods. You don't have to go crazy borderline mm-hmm. carnivore to get mm-hmm. the benefits or to correct for some of the potential nutrient deficiencies. And this is a topic in Real Food for Pregnancy, I write about the challenges of a vegetarian diet. At the end of chapter 3, I actually almost didn't even include it in the book because I'm look, I don't want to focus on the things that are good here. I'm going to focus on this is what happens when you consume enough of these things, not all the problems of not eating them. And I had some early reviewers who were no, I think you really should write about it more, leave it in there. So actually in this third book, which is on fertility, there's a whole chapter on vegetarian diets, specifically as it relates to fertility, mm-hmm. Both male and female fertility. Of course, there's a little bit of the pregnancy conversation looped in there, but I think I take the information much further than I did in Real Food for Pregnancy. We're looking at it from many different angles and at an even more deeper level. But I think my favorite part of that chapter is I included some sections on transitioning away from a vegetarian diet and then considerations for reincorporating animal foods, because that's the second part of the conversation where people are oh no, I think I'm low in all of these things, but mm-hmm. I can't imagine eating a different way.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kind of walk you through how to do that. And again, since this hits so close to home, I feel like I am usually a careful communicator on the topic. And I really am trying to hold your hand through this process and not be this is bad, do this instead. Yep. I'm giving you options and stepping stones, and you might do this, or maybe this is more important to you, so you might do that. But I think it's going to be a really useful resource, because inevitably after like dismantling the arguments against saturated fat and cholesterol and salt, dismantling the argument about vegetarianism is probably an even bigger challenge, but I think it's one that will be received well.
Well, I'm so excited about your new book. Can you tell us about it, where to find it, and what readers will find inside?
Yes. So it's called Real Food for Fertility. I co-authored it with a colleague of mine, Lisa Hendrickson-Jack. She's the author of The Fifth Vital Sign and host of the Fertility Friday podcast. Mm-hmm. So we combine the best of both worlds. You know, I bring in the nutrition component. She's a fertility awareness educator, so she brings in that side of it and the menstrual cycle. And we're kind of combining our decades of experience with working with clients, women of childbearing age, on improving their fertility. So we're tackling not just the nutritional aspects, but the lifestyle stuff, a lot of different common fertility challenges. I mean, mm-hmm. 1 in 6 or 1 in 7 couples are facing fertility challenges. So that's all in there. I mean, there's a whole chapter on egg quality. There's a whole chapter on sperm quality. There's a whole chapter on PCOS, a whole chapter on hypothalamic amenorrhea. A lot of these really common issues that can get in the way of pregnancy from happening. I mean, I've been happy to support through my books, existing books, you know, women's health during pregnancy, but I'm constantly asked about fertility and what can I do to improve my health before I conceive. And it really is optimal if you can to do that, because there's actually a huge article came out with the Green Journal Obstetrics and Gynecology on how pre-pregnancy health impacts the risk for pregnancy complications, like gestational diabetes, for example. And it's huge. If we can improve your health and your partner's health preconception, you can dramatically improve your experience of pregnancy, not just how like easy and comfortable you feel, but also like serious things like your risk for complications and issues at birth and, you know, optimizing your baby's development. Some of these very, very early things that happen in baby's development, like all of the organs are formed by week 8. You only find out that you're pregnant by like week 4 based on how pregnancies are dated. Yeah.
Week 8. Oh my gosh.
And yeah. Any of the severe birth defects, like neural tube defects, those are happening at like week 5 and 6 of pregnancy, which is why there's been that big campaign about improving folate status before pregnancy through the wrong means, but still they want to harp on it because you don't have enough time to correct for a folate deficiency in 1 to 2 weeks after you get a positive pregnancy test. And that's if you're actually like checking regularly, right? Some women don't even know they're pregnant until 6, 7, 8 weeks or even beyond. And then you've missed that crucial stage. So it's really that preconception health that's so crucial. I mean, the time it takes for an egg to develop or for sperm to develop, you need to rewind the clock at least several months to be impacting the quality of egg and sperm, and thus the quality of, you know, that embryo and its chances of implanting properly, the chances of the placenta forming properly. I mean, you look at almost all the most significant pregnancy complications, and a lot of them have a placental component. And that comes down to like the health of your uterus, your hormone balance, like how receptive was your endometrium for implantation to take place, but also what was the quality of the sperm? Because a significant amount of the genetics expressed in the placenta are actually of paternal origin.
Right.
So it's like crazy, right? It's like it's all related. Right. So I really look forward to people checking out this book. And I hope that it's a helpful guide on your journey, whether you're going into your first pregnancy or your in-between pregnancies. I feel better now having a resource instead of being like, just read the pregnancy book and then apply all the things from the pregnancy book. That doesn't always feel good when you're in trying to conceive mode. So I think this will be a really helpful resource.
Well, and that's something that I love about your work. I mean, I got a lot out of it with pregnancy in mind, but I'm like, this is just great dietary info for how to live well.
Yes.
Like this, I mean, this advice is
ultimately real food is real food. You're going to find different rationale for eating certain ways at different stages of life. There's mm-hmm. different things that are important. You would think that this next book is like smaller than Real Food for Pregnancy because I already said everything that needs to be said, but fertility is complicated because it's really a reflection of whole body health. And you're not limited by, like with pregnancy, you're limited by the, you know, the things that you can supplement with, for example, out of like just what's been studied or what's safe. When you're outside of pregnancy, there's so much more that you can do potentially. So ironically, it's actually a lot longer of a book because there's just the breadth of material is so much larger than just focusing, zeroing in on these 9 months.
So where can folks find you, follow you, and how can they best support your work?
Yeah, you can find me on my website. So lilynicholsrdn.com. That's, of course, where you can find my books. So just click the book tab and it'll link out. You can, of course, also look up my books on Amazon or on my website. I link out to my bookshop. Let's see. You can certainly start reading my blog. There's lots of articles up there. There's no paywall on my website, and I put a lot of very in-depth content on it. You can find me on Instagram. My handle's the same as my website. So LilyNicholsRDN. That's often a place where I'm posting, you know, new research that I come across. I publish little research briefs. I publish pictures of my food, so you can kind of just see sort of day-to-day what does real food look like to me? And you may also see that there's occasionally things like pie on there, you know, like I'm also a human being who enjoys having some treats. And if you want to, probably the best way to support my work though, would be to grab a copy of one of my books, whether you want to do a, you know, save money and do an ebook or get the full on paperback. I hear from a lot of people that they end up getting both. They might start with the ebook, then they want like a reference guide that they can refer to quickly and highlight and put sticky notes mine up. On. So that's really fun. And I appreciate every single purchase.
Lily, thank you so much for your time, for coming on. We will link to Real Food for Fertility in the show notes so everyone can grab their copies. And I'm just, it was a real honor to talk to you and learn from you. Thank you.
Thank you. It was really fun.
Thank you so much for joining me today on Choose Wisely. I hope your next meal is delicious and your next conversation nuanced. Thank you to G5 Agency for sponsoring this episode. Choose Wisely is produced by me and edited by Lauren DeLuca. You can rate and review the podcast. Just take 5 seconds and do that within your podcast app. We appreciate it so much. You can find us on Instagram at Choose Wisely Podcast. On Patreon at patreon.com/choosewiselypodcast. You can become a regenerator or a sustainabore. And you can email us at choosewiselypodcast@gmail.com.